I'm very happy to be here at the Perimeter. It's my first time here, so. Right. So, clear a little bit of board space, but stick mostly to slides. So, right, I'm going to talk about derived categories and VGIT, a variation of geometric invariant theory quotients, or probably maybe what people are happier hearing in this crowd would be the B model and phase change. So I guess this is a little outdated. Parts of this talk will be about work with lots of different authors, so I won't list them all. But the core about GIT is about work that I did with Matt Ballard and Ludmil Kutcherkov. So any theorems I state will be part of that joint work. So I want to start with this technical definition and hopefully give you some examples of what this thing is. So if I have some category T, and I want to simplify it into smaller pieces. The way that I do that in a triangulated category is I describe all the objects in terms of triangles. So I start with an object T, and I take some approximation to it and find a triangle, and then I take another piece, find a triangle, and I break it down until I get zero. It's sort of like a filtration by objects in the triangulated category of any object. So what that is in practice is it's a I basically describe the triangulated category in terms of pieces, subcategories A1 through AM, and each object can be built by triangles consisting of objects in these subcategories, and they satisfy the property that the morphisms between these categories only go in one direction. Okay, so that's something. But let's get a sense of how those really exist. Well, one thing that was mentioned in this conference was exceptional collections. So you can take the case where each of these categories is the derived category of a point, right? And then each of the subcategories is just generated by a single object. You can think about it as a Lagrangian, or you can think about it as a coherent sheaf, or whatever you like. And then you just write, okay, this category T is basically generated by these objects E1 through ES, and the morphisms between these objects just go in one direction. They just go forward. So for example, you have a theorem of Balanchine that the derived category of projective space, coherent sheaves on projective space, has such a description. You just take the sheaves on projective space O through O of N. And so if I take P2, then I can think of these objects as vertices. So this is there's a hockey stick somewhere. I can't be here and not use this hockey stick. Now, being at a Canadian university, I have to be, actively promoting Canada during my talks. So this object here is O, O of one and O of two, right? And well, what are the morphisms from O to O of one? Well, they're homogeneous polynomials of degree one, right? So they're labeled by the linear monomials x0, x1, and x2, and formal combinations of these three arrows will create all linear monomials. Similarly here, this is morphisms from O of 1 to O of 2. Will also be labeled by three arrows. And if I want to go from O to O of 2, then I need to concatenate those arrows, right? So I draw some path here, O, X2. So that would this arrow here, this combination would be the quadratic term X0, X2, for example. Okay. So that describes the endomorphism algebra of the sum of these objects, is pictured here. Right. I'm describing exactly morphisms between O, O of 1, and O of 2 in this picture. That's the endomorphism object algebra of the sum of these objects. Okay. So, so I can choose some particular coefficients here and call this the mirror to P2, for example. Okay? And this mirror has three singular fibers. Okay, so I have this vibration over the line, A2. It has three singular fibers. Maybe I'll draw. So I have something, and it has three singular fibers. And then I choose some generic fiber here. Okay, and in here, I take some circles in this generic fiber, and they degenerate. They're vanishing cycles in this generic fiber. They should intersect somehow. Okay? They should intersect somehow. So I'll draw that better. I'll give you a slide that's a better picture of that, exactly how they intersect in a second. Okay? So so it turns out that Seidel defined this category of Lefschetz thimbles in such a way that you get exactly this structure, a semi-orthogonal decomposition. So given a vibration, you just choose an order to the singular fibers, and basically your categories are just the category of Lagrangians, Lagrangian thimbles degenerating to each fiber. Those are your AIs. And then just based on the way that Seidel defined it, you automatically get the structure of a semi-orthogonal decomposition because you chose an order to those things. E2? This? This is C2. C2. C star squared. Oh, I see. Yeah, there's. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's a mistake. Yeah. C star squared. A2 does mean C2, but should be C star squared. Yeah. Sorry. And that mistake carries on. So, okay, so similarly, I can get this one extra term here if I look at the blow-up of P2. Okay, I just have one extra term here. So I can imagine putting a parameter here and deforming it to 0 to look at the difference between. So I have this complex parameter here, and as I deform it to 0, there's some relation between P2 and P2 blown up at one point. And what happens in this mirror, right? Well, actually, I get exactly one additional singular fiber. Right? There's exactly one additional singular fiber. So this is pictured like this. This is the torus. This is the generic fiber. And the Star of David is the way that are the three Lagrangians on P2. That are mirror to O, O of 1, and O of 2. And then as I blow up, say, this is a generic picture for a Del Pezzo, but as I blow up one, I'll introduce, say, this green line. If I blow up another point, I'll introduce, say, this red line. And I'll get some sort of story like this so now these are the three Lagrangians, 1, 2, 3. These are their intersections. Each point in the Star of David should intersect the next in three points. So these are their intersections, are represented by these arrows. And then there's a new guy, maybe this green guy, and then there's some number of intersections between the Star of David points and the new guy. Okay, and so that's also pictured by a quiver. All right. So, of course, the relationship between P2 and P2 blown up at one point is seen by the secondary fan in the toric construction, right? So if I take the secondary fan of P2 blown up in one point, right? Not if I take the secondary fan of P2, but if I take the secondary fan of P2 blown up at one point, it looks like this. And there's these two phases. And one of them's P2. One of them you just blow down a point. And then there's this regular phase. And so I'd like to talk slightly more generally in this introduction. If I take a Hertzebruch surface, N, Fn, and I compare it to P11n, those are also look like the same sort of relation in the secondary fan. So let's start by just looking at quivers on these two spaces and comparing them. Okay, so here I have P11n, okay? And in general, that also has an exceptional collection. You can generalize Balanchine to just take the sum from O to O of the sum of the weights. I happen to do this one, which is, since I did 1, 1, and n, the sum of the weights is n plus 2. Okay, so I have this guy. And now I've drawn a picture of P114. Okay? So again, so this is O. This is O of 1. Between O and O of 1 now, there's only two things of degree 1 now. There's just x0 and x1. And x2 has degree 4. So it maps from O to 1, 2, 3, 4 to O of 4. Right? Similarly here, from O of 1 to O of 5, there's this x2. Right? So it looks like this. And now let's do the Hertzebruch surface. So the Hertzebruch surface, it's a projective bundle over P1. So I have this map, pi, projecting down to P1. And I can pull back O of 1 on P1. Or I can take the relative bundle for this projective bundle. And I can look at then O. I can look at the pullback. I can look at the relative bundle. Or I can look at the tensor product of the two. Okay, so that gives me four things. And in fact, those four also give me exceptional collection on the Hertzebruch surface. And when I draw that exceptional collection, it looks like this. And these are now just the labeling of the arrows, but they're meant to be leading you somewhere. So right now, just pretend these are just labels. X0, X1. Okay, I have four arrows between these two vertices. I have another arrow here, another arrow here, and arrows here. But let's compare the two pictures. Okay. Okay. So here are the two pictures. Now, what you notice is, imagine pretending these two arrows, these two vertices did not exist. Right? Imagine pretending these two vertices did not exist. Right? So just think about what it looks like to take these four outer vertices on this quiver. Okay. So the point is that if I think about that, well, x0, x1 is actually supposed to be the same as x1, x0. And so forth. So between these two vertices, I actually just get degree 3 monomials. Okay? So degree 3 monomials here are the labels of these four arrows, x naught cubed, x naught 1 squared. So that's four arrows. So here's x naught x1. Now jumping from here to here, that's my x2. And jumping from here to here, that's my x2 here. So in fact, just taking four of the vertices in this quiver gives me exactly this picture, which is x4, or which is f4. Okay. So that can be written very nicely. It just means that the derived category of coherent sheaves on P114 has a semi-orthogonal decomposition, which consists of the derived category of this Herzenberg surface and two additional objects, which were those two vertices. And you know, if you play around with this in general, there's three different cases. So you can vary n. There's three different cases. Well, n less than 2 is kind of silly. That's the case we started with. That's the blow up of P2 at a point. So by n less than 2, I mean n equals 1. that's the blow up of P2 at a point, right? And there is, in that case, you get the derived category of P2. And you get this one additional singular fiber we saw in the mirror, or in other words, one additional object, which is actually the structure sheaf of the exceptional divisor for the blow-up. Okay, so there's that relationship. When n equals 2, you actually get an equivalence between these two things, P112 and F2. The derived categories are equivalent. And this was the case we just talked about. For example, when n equals 4, there is the Herzenberg surface sits, the derived category of the Herzenberg surface sits inside the derived category of P114, and there were two additional objects. In general, there's n minus 2 additional objects. Okay. So if you like, so you know, these observations go back to Uru, Katzerkopf, and Orlov. So the way that they described mirror symmetry for the Herzenberg surface, for example, is you took the Hori-Waffe mirror for this Hori-Waffe mirror, for example. So this is the case that so this is an image from their paper. This is the case that n equals 8. All right, n equals 8. And so you have this mirror, and you introduce this parameter b on this term, okay? And so you're deforming the complex structure. This doesn't change the Fukaya category of this mirror at all until b goes to 0. But what you notice is that as you deform b towards 0, there's exactly four of these points which stay in a bounded region, and the rest of the points go off towards infinity. Okay, so that is exactly how they described the Fukaya category of the mirror. They took the Lagrangians, which stayed within a bounded region as you deform b to 0. Okay, and those four points are exactly the Herzenberg surface. Those are exactly the Lagrangians of the Herzenberg surface. So this is how they're seen. You deform in the complex moduli space of the mirror, and that pulls out this phase. Okay. So let me give you the general setup of my work with Ballard and Katzerkopf. So you start with some smooth projective variety, or maybe a stack, and a group acting on that variety, and a one-parameter subgroup of that group. Okay, so you just start with this data. All right. So from this, you can look at the fixed locus of this one-parameter subgroup, And maybe we'll just assume it's connected. It doesn't really matter. You can choose a connected component if you like. From that, you get two contracting loci. Okay? So these are actually supposed to be points where their limit lies in this chosen component. Or if I assume it's connected, then these definitions are correct. So I can look at I can look at points whose limit under this one parameter subgroup is the fixed locus. Or I can look at points whose limit under the inverse of this one parameter subgroup is the fixed locus. Okay? So I get these two contracting loci into the fixed locus of this one parameter subgroup. All right, and then actually what I need to do if G is not abelian, I need to take the orbit of these contracting loci. Okay. So from this you get two stacks. You can take X, you can remove one of the contracting loci in quotient by G, or you can take X and you can remove the other contracting locus and quotient by G. Okay, so we have two stacks. And I just left this up for you. Okay, and now I want to put on a technical condition that says these stacks are nicely related to each other. So this happens, for example, in any case in toric geometry. This happens in most cases in GIT as well. Okay, I'll define an elementary wall crossing to be a one-parameter subgroup, okay, and a choice of the fixed locus, so that these contracting loci are smooth and closed, and that there's a natural morphism to the isomorphism between the orbit and this this product over a group I haven't defined for you. So I'll put that on the next slide. This is a parabolic subgroup, which maybe I'll just say if G is abelian, this is G. These cancel out, and the orbit is equal to the contracting locus. So there's nothing to say. So this is something that appears in GIT theory. This parabolic group is the set of elements in G whose, when you conjugate by the one-parameter subgroup and take the limit as you go to zero, this exists. So of course, if you're abelian, that's an empty condition. And then I describe for you the action. Okay. So now I want to extract a number from this data. Okay, I want to extract for you a number. So okay, again, we have a variety with a group action, a one-parameter subgroup. Now I want to take equivariant line bundle, connected component. So this was all the data from before, but now I chose a point in that fixed locus and an equivariant line bundle. Okay, so now to that I want to associate a number. This was done by Mumford. You take mu of L lambda x, is just the weight of the C star action determined by lambda on the fiber of the geometric vector bundle associated to L. Okay. So you just get you just look at the weight of this action on L. That gives you a number. More generally, you can take a vector bundle here, and then you get a set of weights. So this is called Mumford's numerical function. And I want to look at the value of Mumford's numerical function on a particular thing. We call it mu. And so mu is the difference between the value of Mumford's numerical function on, one, you have the relative cotangent bundle, you have the relative canonical bundle to the positive contracting locus, and you have the relative cotangent bundle to the negative contracting locus. Okay? And now I just take Mumford's numerical function on both of those and take their difference. That's a number. Okay? So I get this number that I can associate to the original setup I had. It comes with a number. Okay. So now the general theorem, okay, is that these two quotient stacks I had are exactly related by semi-orthogonal decompositions, and the way they're related depends on this number, whether this number is positive, negative, or equal to zero. So if this number is positive, then quotient stack, the negative quotient stack embeds into the positive quotient stack, just one category sitting inside another. And so this is this one, and so I had to condense notation a little bit. So this is the small guy sitting inside the big guy, right? And then the additional pieces are also described exactly geometrically. The additional pieces, okay, so I'll simplify what this thing is in a second, all right? But the additional pieces are essentially coherent sheaves on the fixed locus modulo the centralizer of the of lambda. So I get another stack, which is the fixed locus, and I have the centralizer. Okay, so that gives you an exact description of this derived category, where the remaining pieces are exactly also geometric spaces. So when mu is zero, these are just equivalent. The two quotients are equivalent. And when mu is negative, this setup is completely symmetric. So you just get the exact opposite state. Okay, and now I wanted to simplify what this thing is. So where did I write it was zero? Okay, so this thing here, assume, so can be, you can get something more complicated if you don't have a character which splits lambda, right? If you don't have a character such that lambda composed with chi is 1, then these can be some interesting representations in some case or something along these lines. But in the nice case, but it's true that this thing always had a label. If I put a 0 here, then this is a nice space. This is just the fixed locus modulo the reduced centralizer action. So you take the centralizer mod out by the one parameter. The one parameter subgroup acts trivially on the fixed locus. So you want to take the centralizer acting on the fixed locus, but you want to mod out by the action of the one parameter subgroup so that you just get a nice reduced action here. So so that's exactly, this is some nice space, okay? And then, of course, tensoring by a character will give you isomorphisms between this and its shifts. So in the case where it splits, all of these are the just derived categories of this nice space. All of these extra things are just derived categories of this nice space. So we started with the Hertzsprung surface. In that case, this is a point, and all of these additional things are a point. Okay, that's so special case. So you have to keep track of a lot of things, I realize. Let's say I want to do projective space, or more generally, a projective bundle. Well, you can just say what all of this data is in that case, right? So take some base scheme, then take a base variety. Yeah, take a projective a vector bundle on that base, and let X be the total space of that vector bundle. Okay. Well, a special case. Well, first of all, so now you have a group action by C star on the total space of any vector bundle on any space. That's just you scale the fibers, right? And Okay, well, I have a one parameter subgroup of C star itself. And I have the fixed locus of that C star action is just the zero section of this vector bundle. Okay, and so then there's two different contracting loci, right? There's the points which, as I limit to zero, lie in the fixed locus, right? Well, that's the whole space. And there's the points where, as I limit to infinity, lie in the fixed locus. That's only the fixed locus itself. Okay. So what does that mean in terms of what these two spaces are? Well, one of them, the contracting locus was the whole thing. So when I delete the contracting locus, I get the empty set. And the other thing, the contracting locus was, well, it was just the fixed locus itself. So I just delete the zero section. I mod out by C star, I get a projective bundle. Okay. So what this theorem tells you is that the projective bundle has some relation to the empty set. Okay, maybe that doesn't seem so interesting, except that, I still can describe the difference between these two things in terms of the fixed locus. Well, the fixed locus in this case was the zero section, which is equivalent to the base variety, and I just get exactly some number of copies of the fixed locus in this case as the additional thing. So this tells me that the derived category of a projective bundle has a decomposition into a number of derived categories of the base. This was the theorem of Orlov. And if I let B be a point, then I get exactly this theorem of Baylinson that I started with, right? Because this is just an exceptional collection now. This is just a derived category of a point some number of times. Okay. So, of course, we can't. So this framework we're talking about, take a space X, look at a group action. This appears in toric geometry, as I'm sure most of you know. You take the Cox ring of the toric variety, and you quotient out by the dual of the Picard group. Okay, and that gives you a realization of your toric variety as a quotient. So, for example, you could do it for the Hertzsprung surface. In that case, this is correctly A4. And so you have a four-dimensional vector space. And you have your Picard rank is 2. So you have C star squared acting on a four-dimensional vector space. This is a description of the action. Go back to this picture. You play this game, and you get one-parameter subgroups, which behave nicely, I call the elementary wall crossings. Well, of course, that was a hint towards the fact that they're exactly determined by these walls in this GIT fan. Okay, so in this case, this is a one-parameter subgroup you can choose. You could also choose these, and these will give you you can choose this, and this will compare these two GIT quotients. Or you could choose, for example, this. If you choose this, you're going to get a comparison between Fn and the empty set, right? And that's going to describe Fn in terms of some fixed locus data. In this case, it will be 4 points, 4 copies of a point. And then you'll get the quiver for Fn. In this case, there'll be n plus 2. And you'll get the quiver description of that P11n. And then this is the relationship that I described between the two. And that varies with n. And so, of course, this description I told you, which you can get from just playing around with the quivers in this case, follows from this theorem. So another important theorem in the subject is a result of Kawamata. So there's a theorem of Kawamata that says on any toric variety, in fact, any smooth projective toric Deligne-Mumford stack, there is the derived category of coherent sheaves on that variety admits an exceptional collection. It can be described by some finite number of points. Well, how do you do that? Well, we essentially already know. You start in some chamber here. Start in some phase. And you can choose actually a straight line. You just choose it in the opposite direction of the canonical bundle. And once you do that, you just choose a straight line running away from the canonical bundle. You'll get a description in terms of toric varieties of lower dimension. You use induction. Eventually, you get down to a point. And so, so if I start here, I have sort of these two choices of minimal model runs of P11n. Here, Fn, I have to just run away this way. Okay? And so I'm assuming here that n is greater than 2. And okay, so so that gives you a way of decomposing this category based on a choice of a minimal model run. Okay. And you get an exceptional collection. So what happens in mirror symmetry? Well, actually, Diemer, Katzerkopf, and Kerr constructed a moduli space of Landau-Ginzburg models. Okay, so this is a complex moduli space, and as you're moving in that space, actually you can move towards the boundary based on a choice of a minimal model run. So if you choose a minimal model run, you get a deformation to the boundary of this complex moduli space. And as you do that, you can keep track of the singular fibers of this Landau-Ginzburg model. And as you do that, well, I'm going to run through a certain number of chambers, and I'm going to introduce a certain number of singular fibers at each as I cross each wall. Okay? And what happens is that asymptotically, these singular fibers actually grow exactly in differing rates depending on this chamber decomposition. So this is seen exactly in the mirror as the rate of growth of the singular fibers as they go towards infinity. So again, this phase maybe here stays in a bounded region, and the rest go off towards infinity, but at different rates. So this theorem also works for Landau-Ginzburg models. So even though I've been talking about the Landau-Ginzburg mirror to a Fano variety, I can also talk about just the Landau-Ginzburg model, the B model of a Landau-Ginzburg model. So I can talk about the derived category of factorizations and try and do the same game. Well, again, first I want to say what that means for me. So I just start with the space. The data looks similar, but that's just a sort of a coincidence. I start with a space, a group acting on that space, an equivariant line bundle, and a section of a G-invariant section of that equivariant line bundle. Okay, so to that I get a quadruple of data, and so to that I can associate a category. So I can think about the B model for this Landau-Ginzburg model. That's going to be factorizations. So factorizations look like two periodic complexes in this data. So what does that mean, right? Well, I have a space X, so I can take pairs of sheaves, E0 and E1. I know people might be used to free modules or something like that or on a ring, but I claim this is actually a more robust model. It works in any situation. You don't have to be working on a vector space or anything like that. So you just take pairs of sheaves, okay? You take pairs of sheaves, and then you just demand that the square, so you also have morphisms from the sheaf twisted by L to, it looks like I messed up, but maybe I write it here. Looks like I have the L on the wrong side. So, you know, you have E0, and then you have another sheaf E1, and then you have E0 tensor L, and then you have E1 tensor L. Okay. You have alpha beta. This is alpha, and then alpha beta equals beta alpha is your potential, of course. Okay, so this is familiar to people, and this works in this general language. But you have to be careful because since you took sheaves, you have to do something similar to how you construct the derived category, and you have to localize appropriately. But you can localize, and you can recover all the usual models of factorizations. So I'll just say you get a category this way. And the same theorem holds. Okay. So the assumption is that you have some function w on x, right? So then you can just restrict that to these two open sets, or these two open sets, which consist of the complement of this of these two contracting loci. So you can take x minus one of the contracting loci and restrict the potential to that, or you can take x minus the other contracting loci and restrict the potential to that. You get this derived category of this Landau-Ginzburg model, and they're related in the exact same way. Except now, well, I mean, the analog is still true. The additional pieces are described by Landau-Ginzburg models on the fixed locus. So how much time do I have? 10 minutes? That's not very true, right? I'm like already way over, right? Oh, no. Oh, yeah, 2:30. and of course, if this mu is zero, you get equivalences between Landau-Ginzburg models. And again, this is completely symmetric. So you just describe one in terms of the other in terms of this parameter mu. So I want to relate this since I have time. I want to relate this to theorem of Orlov. So first I need to tell you this theorem of Isak and Shipman, which I think is a construction that is very familiar to people in the audience. You start with a variety and a vector bundle on that variety, right? And a section of that vector bundle. So I have the zero set of this section, right? And I want to describe this as a Landau-Ginzburg model. Well, there's a nice Landau-Ginzburg model you can take. You just take the total space of the dual vector bundle, and then you can pair with that section. That gives you a function on the total space of the dual vector bundle. Okay? So, right. So I have maybe some complete intersection or something like that. In X, And then I just think about the total space of, I don't know, O of D to the N on projective space, and I pair with the function which determines this complete intersection, and that gives me a Landau-Ginzburg model. Okay, so the statement is that actually I want to gauge that by C star. So I add a C star, a fiberwise C star action, okay? And then the derived category of coherent sheaves on the zero locus of this section is exactly the derived category of this vector bundle with this of this Landau-Ginzburg model. This gauged Landau-Ginzburg model. Okay. So I have this statement. And so what I can do is I can start with the zero locus of some, maybe some hypersurface or maybe some complete intersection, right? I can move up to this vector bundle, and then I can try and perform GIT, meaning I can try and find some other space such that these are two quotients, so such that the total space of this vector bundle is one of its GIT quotients, or is one of these stacks that I described. So let's take a hypersurface in projective space, okay? And it's defined by some function, some section of O of D, so it's a degree D hypersurface, right? And then what this general theorem tells you is that the derived category of this hypersurface is just the total space of O of minus D, together with F, now this is W. This is really pairing with W, okay, and C star, okay? So I have this gauged Landau-Ginzburg model, which replaces my hypersurface, okay? So now let's set X to be this vector space cross C. Okay, this is still a vector space. I'm just calling it a vector space cross C. So, okay, that's X. Let's give it a C star by C star action with weights minus D1 and 1, 0. Okay? Okay, so we give it that. And in fact, what we get is, what we've really done is we've only used the first C star, and then the second one's sort of gone along for the ride. We've varied GIT for the first C star. Okay, so when we do that, so the one parameter subgroup I'm taking is the first C star, all right? And when I look at what the two things are, well, okay, the fixed locus is the origin cross the origin. The contracting loci is either C cross the origin or V cross 0. 0 cross V or C cross 0, right? So those are the two contracting loci. So either I delete 0 from here, or I delete 0 from here. If I delete 0 from here, I sort of projectivize away this C, and I get V. If I delete 0 from here, well, then I projectivize this V, and this becomes a bundle over P of V. Okay? So the two quotients end up just being the total space of O of minus D and the vector space. So what that tells me is that, well, the hypersurface is related to the total space of this vector bundle, okay? It's equivalent. And then I can compare, therefore, the hypersurface with the quotient of the vector space. So you get this affine description of the hypersurface, which just, this is the theorem of Orlov, which just says exactly that the derived category of the hypersurface in the case where mu is positive looks like the derived category of this affine or this vector space, this Landau-Ginzburg model, this GLSM, right, this linear sigma model, gauged linear sigma model, and then it has some extra pieces based on exactly the number is the parameter. In the Calabi-Yau case, this Calabi-Yau hypersurface, then the GIT is also an equivalent. And the Calabi-Yau hypersurface is exactly factorizations of this GLSM. And in the other case, this GLSM has a description where it has these extra pieces and then the drive category of the hypersurface. So this is something complicated, but I have time, I guess. So one thing you could try and do is you had this diagram, right? You can do this this change from a hypersurface into the total space of a bundle. And then you can do GIT, and that gives you Orlov morally. I mean, this is now a more general picture, but that gives you Orlov morally. And then you could try and fill it back in, meaning I start with a geometric phase, I go up to the Landau-Ginzburg model, I change phases, and then I try and pull out a new geometric phase. Okay. And if I do this, well, one thing I could try and do is do this for the universal hyperplane section of a variety. So this is the family of hyperplane sections, of all hyperplane sections. Okay. And I claim what you do if you do this for the family of all hyperplanes is what's called homological projective duality. So let me tell you a little bit about homological projective duality in the time I have left. So you start with a projective variety. And the classical projective duality tells you you want to look at the set of tangent planes of that projective variety and compare it to them. So in this setting, you start with a projective variety and a decomposition of that projective variety. You want to learn something about the hyperplane sections of that of the drive category of that projective variety. So I wanna take some complete intersection in that projective variety and describe it. So let's take a subspace of V star of dimension R. So I take R functions and I cut it down by these hyperplanes. Okay. And then the drive category of the vanishing locus of this vector space then inherits part of this decomposition here, of this semi-orthogonal decomposition, and then there's some remaining piece that we don't understand. Okay, so we can understand this part just by you basically just pull back to the linear section, and this part will remain semi-orthogonal, but there's this new piece that we don't understand. Okay, and so what Kuznetsov did is he said, well, actually, in some nice cases, there exists another space, Y, mapping to the dual projective space. Now, Y is morally the projective dual. It's the set of hyperplane sections of X. Okay, so you take the projective dual of X. And then that also has a decomposition, all right? And then when you look at hyperplane sections of Y, or if you look at complete intersections in Y, they also break down. And in fact, the additional piece is the exact same additional piece you had for X. So that's homological projective duality. Mm-hmm. Why is the set of hyperplane is the set of tangent planes to X? So those lie in the dual vector space. The set of planes in P V star, which are tangent to X, not the tangent bundle, right? But the set of planes in P V, which are tangent to X, are going to be dual hyperplanes. Right? Planes in P V is P V star. So This is the set. So y is the collection of planes tangent to x, which is a subset of PV star. Okay. So why does xl and yl make sense? Is that the question? Yeah, so I kind of swept that under the rug. So I can intersect y with the projectivization of L. It's a linear subspace of V star. Or I can look at the vanishing locus of L on X. That's the comparison. So a nice example is you take W to be a vector space of dimension 7. You take the Grassmannian of two planes in this seven-dimensional vector space. So the Grassmannian always comes with the Pluhar embedding, GKN, into wedge K. In this case, wedge 2, W. So I have this Pluhar embedding of the Grassmannian. And then the Grassmannian has a nice decomposition. Okay, you put A0 through A6 equal to this category generated by three representations of GL2. Okay, so this is the fundamental representation, its second symmetric power, and the trivial representation. Okay, so you have these three representations, and you get this category given by these things. Okay, so it has this decomposition. Y, classically, is just the Pfaffian variety. So that's the set of singular hyperplane sections of the Grassmannian. But in this case, the Pfaffian has its own definition. So that's just the definition of the projective dual. And I'm lying in wedge 2 W star. I can identify that with skew symmetric forms. And I take degenerate skew symmetric forms. So the Pfaffian is just the set of degenerate skew symmetric forms in wedge 2 W star. All right. So that's some space. And in fact, it has a decomposition. There's 13 of these guys. They're all isomorphic to the same. They're all equivalent categories to the same A0. That's a general feature of projective duality that I didn't tell you about. And DBY looks like these 13 guys, 13 copies of these. Okay. So, what you can do is now when you look at the comparison theorem, you can make it so that all of these guys disappear on the left and all of them disappear on the right. Okay, so that, in fact, both of these categories are just CL itself. So that, in fact, these two categories are equal. And how do you do that? Well, you take a seven-dimensional subspace, which means if you count and keep track of the canonical bundle, taking seven linear sections in G2W, or taking, I don't know, a 14-dimensional, I believe it's a 14-dimensional section of the dual, you get two Calabi-Yau threefolds. Okay, so one is a complete intersection in a Grassmannian, and one is a complete intersection in a Pfaffian. You get these two Calabi-Yau threefolds, and then this theorem of Kuznetsov, and this is also a theorem of Calderaro N2, tells you exactly that these two threefolds have equivalent derived categories. So this was also produced physically by Hori and Tong. No. Yeah. Oops. So I just want to say that homological projective duality can be thought of as a sequence of GIT. This more complicated relation between these objects can be thought of in terms of phase changes. You start with the universal hyperplane section, or a linear over the universal section over L. Okay.
You can phase change. But you replace it by its Landau-Ginzburg model. Okay. In general, when you phase change, these things would all be birational. These things aren't birational at all. But if you replace this by Landau-Ginzburg model and then do phase change and then take a geometric phase, so do this sort of full construction, you start with the universal hyperplane section. In here, you'll get just the linear section of x. On the other hand, there's another phase change you can do, and you'll get exactly the linear section of y, which I wrote as HPD for some reason on this slide. Okay, this is the linear section of y, is another phase of this Landau-Ginzburg model for the universal hyperplane section. And then there's another phase, which is the thing that these two things have in common, which is exactly this category CL. Okay. So I'll stop there. Yeah, so the general story with homological projective duality is you take you draw A naught through A as appearing under this red line, right? And then the dual actually fills in the square. So the rest of the B's look like this. Okay? And then you draw a blue line. This distance is the dimension of L. Okay? So you draw a blue line here. And so the general story is dBy, the linear sections of y, plus the stuff on the left will be equal to dBx plus the stuff on the right of the blue line. Okay? But, so I'll draw it now. So the thing I described for the Grassmannian, well, A naught, remember, A naught equaled A6, right? And similarly for B naught, right? Okay? So what this picture looks like, in fact, is you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay? And then you have the rest of it, 13. So in fact, your red line looks like this. The red line is, so this picture is a filtration. So here's A naught. And then I have A1 sitting inside it. Maybe A2 is equal to A1, A3, and then here's A6 sitting inside A5, right? So if they're all equal, the red line just looks like nothing. See what I'm saying? Say it again? You know, when the red line drops down, the A will fall, right? Yeah.
So while the A goes
more. Yeah, so the B is actually, this B here is exactly the quotient of A naught by A1. And so this B here, which appears here, is exactly the quotient of A naught by A6. Yeah, actually, there's a semi-orthogonal decomposition of B into pieces, which are so B plus this guy is a semi-orthogonal decomposition of A naught.